sobbed and wept, her fear and anguish building themselves up into long climaxes. Furious gusts of emotion would come sweeping over her, shaking her as the tempest shakes the trees upon the hills. All her frame would quiver and throb with them. It was as if some dreadful thing rose up within her and took possession of her, torturing her, tearing her. This thing had been wont to set Jurgis quite beside himself, but now he stood with his lips set tightly and his hands clenched. She might weep till she killed herself, but she would not move him this time. Not an inch. Not an inch. Because the sounds she made set his blood to running cold and his lips to quivering in spite of himself. He was glad of the diversion when Teta Elzbieta, pale with fright, opened the door and rushed in. Yet he turned upon her with an oath. "Go out!" he cried. "Go out!" And then, as she stood hesitating, about to speak, he seized her by the arm and half flung her from the room, slamming the door and barring it with a table. Then he turned again and faced Ona, crying, "Now answer me!" Yet she did not hear him. She was still in the grip of the fiend. Jurgis could see her outstretched hands, shaking and twitching, roaming here and there over the bed at will like living things. He could see convulsive shudderings start in her body and run through her limbs. She was sobbing and choking. It was as if there were too many sounds for one throat. They came chasing each other like waves upon the sea. Then her voice would begin to rise into screams, louder and louder, until it broke in wild, horrible peals of laughter. Jurgis bore it until he could bear it no longer, and then he sprang at her, seizing her by the shoulders and shaking her, shouting into her ear, "Stop it, I say! Stop it!" She looked up at him out of her agony. Then she fell forward at his feet. She caught them in her hands, in spite of his efforts to step aside, and with her face upon the floor lay writhing. It made a choking in Jurgis's throat to hear her, and he cried again more savagely than before. "Stop it, I say!" This time she heeded him and caught her breath and lay silent, save for the gasping sobs that wrenched all her frame. For a long minute she lay there, perfectly motionless, until a cold fear seized her husband, thinking that she was dying. Suddenly, however, he heard her voice faintly. "Jurgis, Jurgis." "What is it?" he said. He had to bend down to her, she was so weak. She was pleading with him in broken phrases, painfully uttered. "Have faith in me. Believe me."
"Believe what?"
he cried. "Believe that I know best, that I love you, and do not ask me what you did. Oh, Jurgis, please, please, it is for the best, it is." He started to speak again, but she rushed on frantically, heading him off. "If you will only do it, if you will only believe me, it wasn't my fault, I couldn't help it, it will be all right, it's nothing, it's no harm. Oh, Jurgis, please, please." She had hold of him, and was trying to raise herself to look at him. He could feel the palsied shaking of her hands and the heaving of the bosom she pressed against him. She managed to catch one of his hands and gripped it convulsively, drawing it to her face and bathing it in her tears. "Oh, believe me, believe me," she wailed again, and he shouted in fury, "I will not!" But still she clung to him, wailing aloud in her despair. "Oh, Jurgis, think what you are doing. It will ruin us, it will ruin us. Oh, no, you must not do it." "No, don't. Don't do it. You must not do it. It will drive me mad. It will kill me. Oh, no, no, Jurgis, I'm crazy. It is nothing. You do not really need to know. We can be happy. We can love each other just the same. Oh, please, please, believe me." Her words fairly drove him wild. He tore his hands loose and flung her off. "Answer me," he cried. "God damn it, I say, answer me." She sank down upon the floor, beginning to cry again. It was like listening to the moan of a damned soul, and Jurgis could not stand it. He smote his fist upon the table by his side and shouted again at her, "Answer me!" She began to scream aloud, her voice like the voice of some wild beast.
"Ah! Ah! I can't do it!"
"Why can't you do it?" he shouted.
"I don't know how."
He sprang and caught her by the arm, lifting her up and glaring into her face.
"Tell me where you were last night," he panted. "Quick, out with it!"
Then she began to whisper one word at a time.
"I was in
A house. Downtown.
What house? What do you mean?
She tried to hide her eyes away, but he held her.
Miss Henderson's house, she gasped.
He did not understand at first. Miss Henderson's house, he echoed. And then suddenly, as in an explosion, the horrible truth burst over him, and he reeled and staggered back with a scream. He caught himself against the wall and put his hand to his forehead, staring about him and whispering,
Jesus, Jesus!
An instant later, he leaped at her. As she lay groveling at his feet, he seized her by the throat.
Tell me, he gasped hoarsely. Quick! Who took you to that place?
She tried to get away, making him furious. He thought it was fear or the pain of his clutch. He did not understand that it was the agony of her shame. She still answered him.
Connor!
Connor? He gasped. Who is Connor?
The boss, she answered. The man.
He tightened his grip in his frenzy, and only when he saw her eyes closing did he realize that he was choking her. Then he relaxed his fingers and crouched, waiting, until she opened her lids again. His breath beat hot into her face.
Tell me, he whispered at last. Tell me about it.
She lay perfectly motionless, and he had to hold his breath to catch her words.
I did not want to do it, she said. I tried. I tried not to do it. I only did it to save us. It was our only chance.
Again for a space there was no sound but his panting. Ona's eyes closed, and when she spoke again, she did not open them.
He told me he would have me turned off. He told me he would. We would all of us lose our places. We could never get anything to do. Here, again. He meant it. He would have ruined us.
Yurius's arms were shaking so that he could scarcely hold himself up, and he lurched forward now and then as he listened.
When did this begin? He gasped.
At the very first, she said.
She spoke as if in a trance.
It was their plot. Miss Henderson's plot. She hated me, and he wanted me. He used to speak to me out on the platform. Then he began to make love to me. He offered me money. He begged me. He said he loved me. Then he threatened me. He knew all about us. He knew we would starve. He knew your boss. He knew Maria's. He would hound us to death, he said. Then he said we would all of us be sure of work, always. Then one day he caught hold of me. He would not let go.
Where was this?
In the hallway. At night, after everyone had gone. I could not help it. I thought of you, of the baby, of mother, and the children. I was afraid of him, afraid to cry out.
A moment ago, her face had been ashen gray. Now it was scarlet. She was beginning to breathe hard again. Jurgis made not a sound.
That was 2 months ago. Then he wanted me to come to that house. He wanted me to stay there. He said all of us, that we would not have to work. He made me come there in the evenings. I told you, you thought I was at the factory. And then one night it snowed and I couldn't get back. And last night, the cars were stopped. It was such a little thing, to ruin us all. I tried to walk, but I couldn't. I didn't want you to know. It would have been all right. We could have gone on, just the same. You need never have known about it. He was getting tired of me. He would have let me alone soon. I'm going to have a baby. I'm getting ugly. He told me that. Twice he told me last night. He kicked me last night, too, and now you will kill him. You'll kill him and we shall die.
All this she said without a quiver. She lay still as death, not an eyelid moving, and Jurgis, too, said not a word. He lifted himself by the bed and stood up. He did not stop for another glance at her, but went to the door and opened it. He did not see Elzbieta crouching terrified in the corner. He went out, hatless, leaving the street door open behind him. The instant his feet were on the sidewalk, he broke into a run. He ran like one possessed, blindly, furiously, looking neither to the right nor left. He was on Ashland Avenue before exhaustion compelled him to slow down, and then, noticing a car, he made a dart for it and drew himself aboard. His eyes were wild and his hair flying, and he was breathing hoarsely, like a wounded bull, but the people in the car did not notice this particularly. Perhaps it seemed natural to them that a man who smelt as Jurgis smelt should exhibit an aspect to correspond. They began to give way before him as usual. The conductor took his nickel gingerly with the tips of his fingers and then left him with the platform to himself. Jurgis did not even notice it. His thoughts were far away. Within his soul, it was like a roaring furnace. He stood waiting, waiting, crouching as if for a spring. He had some of his breath back when the car came to the entrance of the yards, and so he leaped off and started again, racing at full speed. People turned and stared at him, but he saw no one. There was the factory, and he bounded through the doorway and down the corridor. He knew the room where Ona worked, and he knew Connor, the boss of the loading gang outside. He looked for the man as he sprang into the room. The truckmen were hard at work, loading the freshly packed boxes and barrels upon the cars. Jurgis shot one swift glance up and down the platform. The man was not on it, but then suddenly he heard a voice in the corridor and started for it with a bound. In an instant more, he fronted the boss. He was a big, red-faced Irishman, coarse-featured and smelling of liquor. He saw Jurgis as he crossed the threshold and turned white. He hesitated one second as if meaning to run, and in the next his assailant was upon him. He put up his hands to protect his face. But Jurgis, lunging with all the power of his arm and body, struck him fairly between the eyes and knocked him backward. The next moment, he was on top of him, burying his fingers in his throat. To Jurgis, this man's whole presence reeked of the crime he had committed. The touch of his body was madness to him. It set every nerve of him a tremble. It aroused all the demon in his soul. It had worked its will upon Ona, this great beast, and now he had it. He had it. It was his turn now. Things swam blood before him, and he screamed aloud in his fury, lifting his victim and smashing his head upon the floor. The place, of course, was in an uproar, women fainting and shrieking and men rushing in. Jurgis was so bent upon his task that he knew nothing of this, and scarcely realized that people were trying to interfere with him. It was only when half a dozen men had seized him by the legs and shoulders and were pulling at him that he understood that he was losing his prey. In a flash, he had bent down and sunk his teeth into the man's cheek, and when they tore him away, he was dripping with blood, and little ribbons of skin were hanging in his mouth. They got him down upon the floor, clinging to him by his arms and legs, and still they could hardly hold him. He fought like a tiger, writhing and twisting, half flinging them off and starting towards his unconscious enemy. But yet others rushed in, until there was a little mountain of twisted limbs and bodies heaving and tossing and working its way about the room. In the end, by their sheer weight, they choked the breath out of him, and then they carried him to the company police station, where he lay still until they had summoned a patrol wagon to take him away. Chapter 16. When Jurgis got up again, he went quietly enough. He was exhausted and half-dazed, and besides, he saw the blue uniforms of the policemen. He drove in a patrol wagon with half a dozen of them watching him, keeping as far away as possible, however, on account of the fertilizer. Then he stood before the sergeant's desk and gave his name and address and saw a charge of assault and battery entered against him. On his way to his cell, a burly policeman cursed him because he started down the wrong corridor and then added a kick when he was not quick enough. Nevertheless, Jurgis did not even lift his eyes. He had lived 2.5 years in Packingtown, and he knew what the police were. It was as much as a man's very life was worth to anger them here in their inmost lair. Like as not, a dozen would pile on to him at once and pound his face into a pulp. It would be nothing unusual if he got his skull cracked in the melee, in which case they would report that he had been drunk and had fallen down, and there would be no one to know the difference or to care. So a barred door clanged upon Jurgis, and he sat down upon a bench and buried his face in his hands. He was alone. He had the afternoon and all of the night to himself. At first, he was like a wild beast that had glutted itself. He was in a dull stupor of satisfaction. He had done up the scoundrel pretty well, not as well as he would have if they had given him a minute more, but pretty well, all the same. The ends of his fingers were still tingling from their contact with the fellow's throat, but then, little by little, as his strength came back and his senses cleared, he began to see beyond his momentary gratification. That he had nearly killed the boss would not help Ona, nor the horrors that she had borne, nor the memory that would haunt her all her days. It would not help to feed her and her child. She would certainly lose her place, while he, what was to happen to him, God only knew. Half the night he paced the floor, wrestling with this nightmare, and when he was exhausted he lay down, trying to sleep, but finding instead, for the first time in his life, that his brain was too much for him. In the cell next to him was a drunken wife-beater, and in one beyond a yelling maniac. At midnight they opened the station house to the homeless wanderers who were crowded about the door, shivering in the winter blast. And they thronged into the corridor outside of the cells. Some of them stretched themselves out on the bare stone floor and fell to snoring. Others sat up, laughing and talking, cursing and quarreling. The air was fetid with their breath. Yet in spite of this, some of them smelt Jorgis and called down the torments of hell upon him while he lay in a far corner of his cell, counting the throbbings of the blood in his forehead. They had brought him his supper, which was duffers and dope, being hunks of dry bread on a tin plate and coffee, called dope because it was drugged to keep the prisoners quiet. Jorgis had not known this, or he would have swallowed the stuff in desperation. As it was, every nerve of him was a quiver with shame and rage. Towards morning the place fell silent, and he got up and began to pace his cell. And then within the soul of him there rose up a fiend, red-eyed and cruel, and tore out the strings of his heart. It was not for himself that he suffered. What did a man who worked in Durham's fertilizer mill care about anything that the world might do to him? What was any tyranny of prison compared with the tyranny of the past, of the thing that had happened and could not be recalled, of the memory that could never be effaced? The horror of it drove him mad. He stretched out his arms to heaven, crying out for deliverance from it. And there was no deliverance. There was no power, even in heaven, that could undo the past. It was a ghost that would not down. It followed him. It seized upon him and beat him to the ground. Ah, if only he could have foreseen it. But then he would have foreseen it if he had not been a fool. He smote his hands upon his forehead, cursing himself because he had ever allowed Ona to work where she had, because he had not stood between her and a fate which everyone knew to be so common. He should have taken her away, even if it were to lie down and die of starvation in the gutters of Chicago streets. And now, oh, it could not be true. It was too monstrous, too horrible. It was a thing that could not be faced. A new shuddering seized him every time he tried to think of it. No, there was no bearing the load of it. There was no living under it. There would be none for her. He knew that he might pardon her, might plead with her on his knees, but she would never look him in the face again. She would never be his wife again. The shame of it would kill her. There could be no other deliverance, and it was best that she should die. This was simple and clear, and yet with cruel inconsistency, whenever he escaped from his nightmare, it was to suffer and cry out at the vision of Ona starving. They had put him in jail, and they would keep him here a long time, years maybe, and Ona would surely not go to work again, broken and crushed as she was. And Elzbieta and Maria, too, might lose their places, if that hell fiend Connor chose to set to work to ruin them. They would all be turned out. And even if he did not, they could not live. Even if the boys left school again, they could surely not pay all the bills without him and Ona. They had only a few dollars now. They had just paid the rent of the house a week ago, and that after it was 2 weeks overdue, so it would be due again in a week. They would have no money to pay it then, and they would lose the house. After all their long, heartbreaking struggle, 3 times now the agent had warned him that he would not tolerate another delay. Perhaps it was very base of Jorgis to be thinking about the house when he had the other unspeakable thing to fill his mind. Yet how much he had suffered for this house, how much they had all of them suffered. It was their one hope of respite as long as they lived. They had put all their money into it, and they were working people, poor people, whose money was their strength. The very substance of them, body and soul, the thing by which they lived, and for lack of which they died. And they would lose it all. They would be turned out into the streets and have to hide in some icy garret and live or die as best they could. Jurgis had all the night and all of many more nights to think about this, and he saw the thing in its details. He lived it all as if he were there. They would sell their furniture and then run into debt at the stores and then be refused credit. They would borrow a little from the Shedvilises, whose delicatessen store was tottering on the brink of ruin. The neighbors would come and help them a little. Poor, sick Jadwiga would bring a few spare pennies, as she always did when people were starving, and Tymosiusz Kuzlejka would bring them the proceeds of a night's fiddling. So they would struggle to hang on until he got out of jail. Or would they know that he was in jail? Would they be able to find out anything about him? Would they be allowed to see him? Or was it to be part of his punishment, to be kept in ignorance about their fate? His mind would hang upon the worst possibilities. He saw Ona ill and tortured, Maria out of her place, little Stanislovas unable to get to work for the snow, the whole family turned out on the street. God Almighty, would they actually let them lie down in the street and die? Would there be no help even then? Would they wander about in the snow till they froze? Jurgis had never seen any dead bodies in the streets, but he had seen people evicted and disappear. No one knew where. And though the city had a relief bureau, though there was a charity organization society in the Stockyards district, in all his life there, he had never heard of either of them. They did not advertise their activities, having more calls than they could attend to without that. So on until morning. Then he had another ride in the patrol wagon along with the drunken wife-beater and the maniac, several plain drunks and saloon fighters, a burglar, and two men who had been arrested for stealing meat from the packing houses. Along with them, he was driven into a large white-walled room, stale-smelling and crowded. In front, upon a raised platform behind a rail, sat a stout, florid-faced personage, with a nose broken out in purple blotches. Our friend realized vaguely that he was about to be tried. He wondered what for, whether or not his victim might be dead, and if so, what they would do with him. Hang him, perhaps, or beat him to death. Nothing would have surprised Jurgis, who knew little of the laws. Yet he had picked up gossip enough to have it occur to him that the loud-voiced man upon the bench might be the notorious Justice Callahan, about whom the people of Packingtown spoke with bated breath. Pat Callahan, Growler Pat, as he had been known before he ascended the bench, had begun life as a butcher boy and a bruiser of local reputation. He had gone into politics almost as soon as he had learned to talk, and had held two offices at once before he was old enough to vote. If Scully was the thumb, Pat Callahan was the first finger of the unseen hand whereby the Packers held down the people of the district. No politician in Chicago ranked higher in their confidence. He had been at it a long time, had been the business agent in the city council of Old Durham, the self-made merchant, way back in the early days when the whole city of Chicago had been up at auction. Growler Pat had given up holding city offices very early in his career, caring only for party power, and giving the rest of his time to superintending his dives and brothels. Of late years, however, since his children were growing up, he had begun to value respectability, and had had himself made a magistrate, a position for which he was admirably fitted because of his strong conservatism and his contempt for foreigners. Jurgis sat gazing about the room for an hour or two. He was in hopes that someone of the family would come, but in this he was disappointed. Finally, he was led before the bar, and a lawyer for the company appeared against him. Connor was under the doctor's care, the lawyer explained briefly, and if his honor would hold the prisoner for a week, $300, said his honor promptly. Jurgis was staring from the judge to the lawyer in perplexity. Have you anyone to go on your bond? demanded the judge, and then a clerk who stood at Jurgis's elbow explained to him what this meant. The latter shook his head, and before he realized what had happened, the policemen were leading him away again. They took him to a room where other prisoners were waiting, and here he stayed until court adjourned, when he had another long and bitterly cold ride in a patrol wagon to the county jail, which is on the north side of the city and 9 or 10 miles from the stockyards. Here they searched Jurgis, leaving him only his money, which consisted of 15 cents. Then they led him to a room and told him to strip for a bath, after which he had to walk down a long gallery past the grated cell doors of the inmates of the jail. This was a great event to the latter. The daily review of the new arrivals, all stark naked, and many and diverting were the comments. Jurgis was required to stay in the bath longer than anyone, in the vain hope of getting out of him a few of his phosphates and acids. The prisoners roomed two in a cell, but that day there was one left over, and he was the one. The cells were in tiers, opening upon galleries. His cell was about 5 feet by 7 in size, with a stone floor and a heavy wooden bench built into it. There was no window. The only light came from windows near the roof at one end of the court outside. There were 2 bunks, one above the other, each with a straw mattress and a pair of gray blankets. The latter, stiff as boards with filth and alive with fleas, bedbugs, and lice. When Jurgis lifted up the mattress, he discovered beneath it a layer of scurrying roaches almost as badly frightened as himself. Here they brought him more duffers and dope, with the addition of a bowl of soup. Many of the prisoners had their meals brought in from a restaurant, but Jurgis had no money for that. Some had books to read and cards to play, with candles to burn by night, but Jurgis was all alone in darkness and silence. He could not sleep again. There was the same maddening procession of thoughts that lashed him like whips upon his naked back. When night fell, he was pacing up and down his cell like a wild beast that breaks its teeth upon the bars of its cage. Now and then, in his frenzy, he would fling himself against the walls of the place, beating his hands upon them. They cut him and bruised him. They were cold and merciless as the men who had built them. In the distance, there was a church tower bell that tolled the hours one by one. When it came to midnight, Jurgis was lying upon the floor with his head in his arms, listening. Instead of falling silent at the end, the bell broke into a sudden clangor. Jurgis raised his head. What could that mean? A fire? God, suppose there were to be a fire in this jail. But then he made out a melody in the ringing. There were chimes, and they seemed to waken the city. All around, far and near, there were bells ringing, wild music. For fully a minute, Jurgis lay lost in wonder, before all at once the meaning of it broke over him. That this was Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve. He had forgotten it entirely. There was a breaking of floodgates, a whirl of new memories and new griefs rushing into his mind. In far Lithuania, they had celebrated Christmas, and it came to him as if it had been yesterday. Himself, a little child, with his lost brother and his dead father in the cabin in the deep black forest, where the snow fell all day and all night and buried them from the world. It was too far off for Santa Claus in Lithuania, but it was not too far off for peace and goodwill to men, for the wonder-bearing vision of the Christ child. And even in Packingtown they had not forgotten it. Some gleam of it had never failed to break their darkness. Last Christmas Eve and all Christmas Day, Jurgis had toiled on the killing beds and Ona at wrapping hams, and still they had found strength enough to take the children for a walk upon the avenue, to see the store windows all decorated with Christmas trees and ablaze with electric lights. In one window there would be live geese, in another marvels in sugar, pink and white canes big enough for ogres and cakes with cherubs upon them. In a third there would be rows of fat yellow turkeys decorated with rosettes and rabbits and squirrels hanging. In a fourth would be a fairyland of toys, lovely dolls with pink dresses and woolly sheep and drums and soldier hats. Nor did they have to go without their share of all this either. The last time, they had had a big basket with them and all their Christmas marketing to do, a roast of pork and a cabbage and some rye bread, and a pair of mittens for Ona, and a rubber doll that squeaked, in a little green cornucopia full of candy to be hung from the gas jet and gazed at by half a dozen pairs of longing eyes. Even half a year of the sausage machines in the fertilizer mill had not been able to kill the thought of Christmas in them. There was a choking in Jurgis's throat, as he recalled that the very night Ona had not come home, Teta Elzbieta had taken him aside and shown him an old valentine that she had picked up in a paper store for 3 cents. Dingy and shop-worn, but with bright colors and figures of angels and doves. She had wiped all the specks off this, and was going to set it on the mantel where the children could see it. Great sobs shook Jurgis at this memory. They would spend their Christmas in misery and despair with him in prison and Ona ill, and their home in desolation. Oh, it was too cruel. Why, at least, had they not left him alone? Why, after they had shut him in jail, must they be ringing Christmas chimes in his ears? But no, their bells were not ringing for him. Their Christmas was not meant for him. They were simply not counting him at all. He was of no consequence. He was flung aside like a bit of trash, the carcass of some animal. It was horrible, horrible. His wife might be dying, his baby might be starving, his whole family might be perishing in the cold, and all the while they were ringing their Christmas chimes. And the bitter mockery of it, all this was punishment for him. They put him in a place where the snow could not beat in, where the cold could not eat through his bones. They brought him food and drink. Why, in the name of heaven, if they must punish him, did they not put his family in jail and leave him outside? Why could they find no better way to punish him than to leave 3 weak women and 6 helpless children to starve and freeze? That was their law. That was their justice. Jurgis stood upright, trembling with passion, his hands clenched and his arms upraised, his whole soul ablaze with hatred and defiance. 10,000 curses upon them and their law, their justice. It was a lie. It was a lie, a hideous, brutal lie. A thing too black and hateful for any world but a world of nightmares. It was a sham and a loathsome mockery. There was no justice. There was no right anywhere in it. It was only force. It was tyranny. The will and the power, reckless and unrestrained. They had ground him beneath their heel. They had devoured all his substance. They had murdered his old father. They had broken and wrecked his wife. They had crushed and cowed his whole family. And now, they were through with him. They had no further use for him. And because he had interfered with them, had gotten in their way, this was what they had done to him. They had put him behind bars as if he had been a wild beast, a thing without sense or reason, without rights, without affections, without feelings. Nay, they would not even have treated a beast as they had treated him. Would any man in his senses have trapped a wild thing in its lair and left its young behind to die? These midnight hours were fateful ones to Jurgis. In them was the beginning of his rebellion, of his outlawry and his unbelief. He had no wit to trace back the social crime to its far sources. He could not say that this was the thing men have called the system that was crushing him to the earth, that it was the packers, his masters, who had bought up the law of the land and had dealt out their brutal will to him from the seat of justice. He only knew that he was wronged, and that the world had wronged him, that the law, that society with all its powers, had declared itself his foe. And every hour his soul grew blacker, every hour he dreamed new dreams of vengeance, of defiance, of raging, frenzied hate. The vilest deeds, like poison weeds, bloom well in prison air. It is only what is good in man that wastes and withers there. Pale anguish keeps the heavy gate, and the warder is despair. So wrote a poet to whom the world had dealt its justice. I know not whether laws be right or whether laws be wrong. All that we know who lie in jail is that the wall is strong. And they do well to hide their hell, for in it things are done that son of God nor son of man ever should look upon. Chapter 17. At 7 o'clock the next morning, Jorgis was led out to get water to wash his cell, a duty which he performed faithfully, but which most of the prisoners were accustomed to shirk until their cells became so filthy that the guards interposed. Then he had more duffers and dope, and afterwards was allowed 3 hours for exercise in a long, cement-walled court roofed with glass. Here were all the inmates of the jail crowded together. At one side of the court was a place for visitors, cut off by 2 heavy wire screens a foot apart, so that nothing could be passed in to the prisoners. Here, Jorgis watched anxiously, but there came no one to see him. Soon after he went back to his cell, a keeper opened the door to let in another prisoner. He was a dapper young fellow, with a light brown mustache and blue eyes and a graceful figure. He nodded to Jorgis, and then, as the keeper closed the door upon him, began gazing critically about him. "Well, pal," he said, as his glance encountered Jorgis again. "Good morning." "Good morning," said Jorgis. "A rum go for Christmas, eh?" added the other. Jorgis nodded. The newcomer went to the bunks and inspected the blankets. He lifted up the mattress and then dropped it with an exclamation. "My God," he said, "that's the worst yet." He glanced at Jorgis again. "Looks as if it hadn't been slept in last night. Couldn't stand it, eh?" "I didn't want to sleep last night," said Jorgis. "When did you come in?" "Yesterday." The other had another look round, and then wrinkled up his nose. "There's the devil of a stink in here," he said suddenly. "What is it?"
"It's me," said Jorgis.
"You?"
"Yes, me."
"Didn't they make you wash?"
"Yes, but this don't wash."
"What is it?"
"Fertilizer."
"Fertilizer? The deuce! What are you?"
"I work in the stockyards. At least I did until the other day. It's in my clothes."
"That's a new one on me," said the newcomer. "I thought I'd been up against them all. What are you in for?"
"I hit my boss."
"Oh, that's it? What did he do?"
He treated me mean."
"I see. You're what's called an honest working man."
"What are you?"
Jorgis asked. "I?" the other laughed. "They say I'm a cracksman," he said.
"What's that?" asked Jorgis.
"Safes and such things," answered the other.
"Oh," said Jorgis wonderingly, and stared at the speaker in awe. "You mean you break into them? You...
"Yes," laughed the other. "That's what they say." He did not look to be over 22 or 23, though, as Jorgis found afterwards, he was 30. He spoke like a man of education, like what the world calls a gentleman.
"Is that what you're here for?" Jorgis inquired.
"No," was the answer. "I'm here for disorderly conduct." They were mad because they couldn't get any evidence. "What's your name?" the young fellow continued after a pause.
"My name's Duane, Jack Duane. I've more than a dozen, but that's my company one."
He seated himself on the floor with his back to the wall and his legs crossed and went on talking easily. He soon put Jorgis on a friendly footing. He was evidently a man of the world, used to getting on, and not too proud to hold conversation with a mere laboring man. He drew Jorgis out and heard all about his life, all but the one unmentionable thing. And then he told stories about his own life. He was a great one for stories, not always of the choicest. Being sent to jail had apparently not disturbed his cheerfulness. He had done time twice before, it seemed, and he took it all with a frolic welcome. What with women and wine and the excitement of his vocation, a man could afford to rest now and then. Naturally, the aspect of prison life was changed for Jorgis by the arrival of a cellmate. He could not turn his face to the wall and sulk. He had to speak when he was spoken to. Nor could he help being interested in the conversation of Duane, the first educated man with whom he had ever talked. How could he help listening with wonder while the other told of midnight ventures and perilous escapes, of feastings and orgies, of fortunes squandered in a night? The young fellow had an amused contempt for Jorgis. As a sort of working mule, he too had felt the world's injustice, but instead of bearing it patiently, he had struck back and struck hard. He was striking all the time. There was war between him and society. He was a genial freebooter, living off the enemy without fear or shame. He was not always victorious, but then defeat did not mean annihilation and need not break his spirit. Withal, he was a good-hearted fellow. Too much so, it appeared. His story came out not in the first day nor the second, but in the long hours that dragged by, in which they had nothing to do but talk, and nothing to talk of but themselves. Jack Duane was from the East. He was a college-bred man, had been studying electrical engineering. Then his father had met with misfortune in business and killed himself. And there had been his mother and a younger brother and sister. Also, there was an invention of Duane's. Jurgis could not understand it clearly, but it had to do with telegraphing, and it was a very important thing. There were fortunes in it, millions upon millions of dollars, and Duane had been robbed of it by a great company and got tangled up in lawsuits and lost all his money. Then somebody had given him a tip on a horse race, and he had tried to retrieve his fortune with another person's money and had to run away, and all the rest had come from that. The other asked him what had led him to safe-breaking, to Jurgis a wild and appalling occupation to think about. A man he had met, his cellmate replied. One thing leads to another. Didn't he ever wonder about his family? Jurgis asked. Sometimes, the other answered, but not often. He didn't allow it. Thinking about it would make it no better. This wasn't a world in which a man had any business with a family. Sooner or later, Jurgis would find that out also and give up the fight, and shift for himself. Jurgis was so transparently what he pretended to be that his cellmate was as open with him as a child. It was pleasant to tell him adventures. He was so full of wonder and admiration. He was so new to the ways of the country. Duane did not even bother to keep back names and places. He told all his triumphs and his failures, his loves and his griefs. Also, he introduced Jurgis to many of the other prisoners, nearly half of whom he knew by name. The crowd had already given Jurgis a name. They called him the Stinker. This was cruel, but they meant no harm by it, and he took it with a good-natured grin. Our friend had caught now and then a whiff from the sewers over which he lived, but this was the first time that he had ever been splashed by their filth. This jail was a Noah's Ark of the city's crime. There were murderers, hold-up men, and burglars, embezzlers, counterfeiters, and forgers, bigamists, shoplifters, confidence men, petty thieves and pickpockets, gamblers and procurers, brawlers, beggars, tramps and drunkards. They were black and white, old and young, Americans and natives of every nation under the sun. There were hardened criminals and innocent men too poor to give bail, old men and boys literally not yet in their teens. They were the drainage of the great festering ulcer of society. They were hideous to look upon, sickening to talk to. All life had turned to rottenness and stench in them. Love was a beastliness, joy was a snare, and God was an imprecation. They strolled here and there about the courtyard, and Jurgis listened to them. He was ignorant, and they were wise. They had been everywhere and tried everything. They could tell the whole hateful story of it, set forth the inner soul of a city in which justice and honor, women's bodies and men's souls were for sale in the marketplace, and human beings writhed and fought and fell upon each other like wolves in a pit, in which lusts were raging fires and men were fuel, and humanity was festering and stewing and wallowing in its own corruption. Into this wild beast tangle these men had been born without their consent. They had taken part in it because they could not help it. That they were in jail was no disgrace to them, for the game had never been fair. The dice were loaded. They were swindlers and thieves of pennies and dimes, and they had been trapped and put out of the way by the swindlers and thieves of millions of dollars. To most of this, Jurgis tried not to listen. They frightened him with their savage mockery, and all the while his heart was far away, where his loved ones were calling. Now and then, in the midst of it, his thoughts would take flight, and then the tears would come into his eyes, and he would be called back by the jeering laughter of his companions. He spent a week in this company, and during all that time he had no word from his home. He paid one of his 15 cents for a postal card, and his companions wrote a note to the family, telling them where he was and when he would be tried. There came no answer to it, however, and at last, the day before New Year's, Jurgis bade goodbye to Jack Duane. The latter gave him his address, or rather the address of his mistress, and made Jurgis promise to look him up. "Maybe I could help you out of a hole some day," he said, and added that he was sorry to have him go. Jurgis rode in the patrol wagon back to Justice Callahan's court for trial. One of the first things he made out as he entered the room was Teta Elzbieta and little Katrina, looking pale and frightened, seated far in the rear. His heart began to pound, but he did not dare to try to signal to them, and neither did Elzbieta. He took his seat in the prisoner's pen and sat gazing at them in helpless agony. He saw that Ona was not with them, and was full of foreboding as to what that might mean. He spent half an hour brooding over this, and then suddenly he straightened up, and the blood rushed into his face. A man had come in. Jurgis could not see his features for the bandages that swathed him, but he knew the burly figure. It was Connor. A trembling seized him, and his limbs bent as if for a spring. Then suddenly he felt a hand on his collar, and heard a voice behind him. "Sit down, you son of a—" He subsided, but he never took his eyes off his enemy. The fellow was still alive, which was a disappointment in one way, and yet it was pleasant to see him, all in penitential plasters. He and the company lawyer, who was with him, came and took seats within the judge's railing, and a minute later the clerk called Jurgis's name, and the policeman jerked him to his feet and led him before the bar, gripping him tightly by the arm, lest he should spring upon the boss. Jurgis listened while the man entered the witness chair, took the oath, and told his story. The wife of the prisoner had been employed in a department near him, and had been discharged for impudence to him. Half an hour later he had been violently attacked, knocked down, and almost choked to death. He had brought witnesses. "They would probably not be necessary," observed the judge, and he turned to Jurgis. "You admit attacking the plaintiff?" he asked. "Him?" inquired Jurgis, pointing at the boss. "Yes," said the judge. "I hit him, sir," said Jurgis. "Say, Your Honor," said the officer, pinching his arm hard. "Your Honor," said Jurgis obediently. "You tried to choke him?" "Yes, sir, Your Honor." "Ever been arrested before?" "No, sir, Your Honor." "Oh, what have you to say for yourself?" Jurgis hesitated. What had he to say? In 2 years and a half, he had learned to speak English for practical purposes, but these had never included the statement that someone had intimidated and seduced his wife. He tried once or twice, stammering and balking, to the annoyance of the judge, who was gasping from the odor of fertilizer. Finally, the prisoner made it understood that his vocabulary was inadequate, and there stepped up a dapper young man with waxed mustaches, bidding him speak in any language he knew. Jurgis began, supposing that he would be given time. He explained how the boss had taken advantage of his wife's position to make advances to her and threatened her with the loss of her place. When the interpreter had translated this, the judge, whose calendar was crowded and whose automobile was ordered for a certain hour, interrupted with the remark, I see. Well, if he made love to your wife, why didn't she complain to the superintendent or leave the place?" Jurgis hesitated, somewhat taken aback. He began to explain that they were very poor, that work was hard to get. "I see," said Justice Callahan. "So instead, you thought you would knock him down." He turned to the plaintiff, inquiring, "Is there any truth in this story, Mr. Connor?"
"Not a particle, Your Honor," said the boss. "It is very unpleasant that they tell some such tale every time you have to discharge a woman."
"Yes, I know," said the judge. "I hear it often enough. The fellow seems to have handled you pretty roughly. 30 days in costs. Next case." Jurgis had been listening in perplexity. It was only when the policeman, who had him by the arm, turned and started to lead him away, that he realized that sentence had been passed. He gazed around him wildly. 30 days? He panted, and then he whirled upon the judge. "What will my family do?" he cried frantically. "I have a wife and baby, sir, and they have no money. My God, they will starve to death."
"You would have done well to think about them before you committed the assault," said the judge dryly as he turned to look at the next prisoner.
Jurgis would have spoken again, but the policeman had seized him by the collar and was twisting him, and a second policeman was making for him with evidently hostile intentions. So he let them lead him away. Far down the room he saw Elspieta and Katrina risen from their seats, staring in fright. He made one effort to go to them, and then, brought back by another twist at his throat, he bowed his head and gave up the struggle. They thrust him into a cell room where other prisoners were waiting, and as soon as court had adjourned, they led him down with them into the Black Maria and drove him away. This time Jurgis was bound for the Bridewell, a petty jail where Cook County prisoners served their time. It was even filthier and more crowded than the county jail. All the smaller fry out of the latter had been sifted into it, the petty thieves and swindlers, the brawlers and vagrants. For his cellmate, Jurgis had an Italian fruit seller who had refused to pay his graft to the policeman and had been arrested for carrying a large pocket knife. As he did not understand a word of English, our friend was glad when he left. He gave place to a Norwegian sailor who had lost half an ear in a drunken brawl and who proved to be quarrelsome, cursing Jurgis because he moved in his bunk and caused the roaches to drop upon the lower one. It would have been quite intolerable staying in a cell with this wild beast, but for the fact that all day long the prisoners were put at work breaking stone. 10 days of his 30 Jurgis spent thus, without hearing a word from his family. Then one day a keeper came and informed him that there was a visitor to see him. Jurgis turned white and so weak at the knees that he could hardly leave his cell. The man led him down the corridor and a flight of steps to the visitor's room, which was barred like a cell. Through the grating, Jurgis could see someone sitting in a chair, and as he came into the room, the person started up, and he saw that it was little Stanislovas. At the sight of someone from home, the big fellow nearly went to pieces. He had to steady himself by a chair, and he put his other hand to his forehead, as if to clear away a mist.
"Well?" he said weakly.
Little Stanislovas was also trembling, and all but too frightened to speak.
They sent me to tell you," he said with a gulp.
"Well?" Jurgis repeated.
He followed the boy's glance to where the keeper was standing watching them.
"Never mind that," Jurgis cried wildly. "How are they?"
"Ona is very sick," Stanislovas said, "and we are almost starving. We can't get along. We thought you might be able to help us."
Jurgis gripped the chair tighter. There were beads of perspiration on his forehead, and his hand shook.
"I can't help you," he said.
"Ona lies in her room all day," the boy went on breathlessly. "She won't eat anything, and she cries all the time. She won't tell what is the matter, and she won't go to work at all. Then a long time ago, the man came for the rent. He was very cross. He came again last week. He said he would turn us out of the house. And then Maria..."
A sob choked Stanislovas, and he stopped.
"What's the matter with Maria?" cried Jurgis.
"She's cut her hand," said the boy. "She's cut it bad this time, worse than before. She can't work, and it's all turning green, and the company doctor says she may have to cut it off, and Maria cries all the time. Her money is nearly all gone, too, and we can't pay the rent and the interest on the house, and we have no coal and nothing more to eat, and the man at the store, he says..."
The little fellow stopped again, beginning to whimper.
"Go on," the other panted in frenzy. "Go on."
I will," sobs Stanislovas. "It's so cold all the time, and last Sunday it snowed again, a deep, deep snow, and I couldn't get to work."
"God!"
Jurgis half shouted, and he took a step towards the child. There was an old hatred between them because of the snow, ever since that dreadful morning when the boy had had his fingers frozen, and Jurgis had had to beat him to send him to work. Now he clenched his hands, looking as if he would try to break through the grating.
"You little villain," he cried. "You didn't try."
I did,
wailed Stanislovas, shrinking from him in terror.
"I tried all day, 2 days. Elzbieta was with me, and she couldn't either. We couldn't walk at all. It was so deep. And we had nothing to eat. And, oh, it was so cold. I tried, and then the third day Ona went with me."
"Ona?"
"Yes, she tried to go to work, too. She had to. We were all starving, but she had lost her place."
Jurgis reeled and gave a gasp.
"She went back to that place," he screamed.
"She tried to," said Stanislavas, gazing at him in perplexity. "Why not, Jurgis?"
The man breathed hard, 3 or 4 times. "Go on," he panted finally.
"I went with her," said Stanislavas, "but Miss Henderson wouldn't take her back, and Connor saw her and cursed her. He was still bandaged up. Why did you hit him, Jurgis?"
There was some fascinating mystery about this, the little fellow knew, but he could get no satisfaction. Jurgis could not speak. He could only stare, his eyes starting out.
"She's been trying to get other work," the boy went on, "but she's so weak she can't keep up, and my boss would not take me back either. Ona says he knows Connor, and that's the reason. They've all got a grudge against us now, so I've got to go downtown and sell papers with the rest of the boys and Katrina."
"Katrina?"
"Yes, she's been selling papers, too. She does best because she's a girl. Only the cold is so bad. It's terrible coming home at night, Jurgis. Sometimes they can't come home at all. I'm going to try to find them tonight and sleep where they do. It's so late and such a long ways home. I've had to walk, and I didn't know where it was. I don't know how to get back, either. Only Mother said I must come because you would want to know, and maybe somebody would help your family when they had put you in jail so you couldn't work. And I walked all day to get here, and I only had a piece of bread for breakfast, Jurgis. Mother hasn't any work either, because the sausage department is shut down, and she goes and begs at houses with a basket, and people give her food, only she didn't get much yesterday. It was too cold for her fingers, and today she was crying."
So little Stanislavas went on, sobbing as he talked, and Jurgis stood, gripping the table tightly, saying not a word, but feeling that his head would burst. It was like having weights piled upon him, one after another, crushing the life out of him. He struggled and fought within himself, as if in some terrible nightmare in which a man suffers in agony and cannot lift his hand nor cry out, but feels that he is going mad, that his brain is on fire. Just when it seemed to him that another turn of the screw would kill him, little Stanislavas stopped.
"You cannot help us,"
he said weakly. Jurgis shook his head.
"They won't give you anything here."
He shook it again.
"When are you coming out?"
3 weeks yet," Jurgis answered, and the boy gazed around him uncertainly.
"Then I might as well go," he said.
Jurgis nodded, then suddenly recollecting, he put his hand into his pocket and drew it out, shaking. "Here," he said, holding out the 14 cents. "Take this to them." And Stanislavas took it, and after a little more hesitation, started for the door.
"Goodbye, Jurgis," he said, and the other noticed that he walked unsteadily as he passed out of sight.
For a minute or so, Jurgis stood clinging to the chair, reeling and swaying. Then the keeper touched him on the arm, and he turned and went back to breaking stone.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
And now, part 2 of The Jungle, written by Upton Sinclair and read by Casey Affleck.
Chapter 18. Jurgis did not get out of the bride well quite as soon as he had expected. To his sentence, there were added court costs of $1.50. He was supposed to pay for the trouble of putting him in jail, and not having the money, was obliged to work it off by 3 days more of toil. Nobody had taken the trouble to tell him this, only after counting the days and looking forward to the end in an agony of impatience. When the hour came that he expected to be free, he found himself still set at the stone heap, and laughed at when he ventured to protest. Then he concluded he must have counted wrong, but as another day passed, he gave up all hope, and was sunk in the depths of despair, when one morning after breakfast a keeper came to him with the word that his time was up at last. So he doffed his prison garb, and put on his old fertilizer clothing, and heard the door of the prison clang behind him. He stood upon the steps, bewildered. He could hardly believe that it was true, that the sky was above him again and the open street before him, that he was a free man. But then the cold began to strike through his clothes, and he started quickly away. There had been a heavy snow, and now a thaw had set in. A fine, sleety rain was falling.